Look at that sword Lumpyhead's got there, Lummy said one morning as they made their plodding way past orchards and wheat fields. He had been a dyer's apprentice before he was caught stealing, and his arms were mottled green to the elbow. When he laughed, he brayed like the donkeys they were riding. Where's a gutter rat like Lumpyhead? Get him a sword. Arya chewed her lip sullenly. She could see the back of Yoren's faded black cloak up ahead of the wagons, but she was determined not to go crying to him for help.
Maybe he's a little squire, Hot Pie put in.
His mother had been a baker before she died, and he'd pushed her cart through the streets all day shouting, Hot pies! Hot pies! Some lordy lord's little squire boy, that's it.
He ain't no squire, look at him.
I'll bet that's not even a real sword. I bet that's just some play sword made of tin.
Arya hated them, making fun of Needle. It's Castle Forge steel, you stupid, she snapped, turning in the saddle to glare at them. And you better shut your mouth. The orphan boys hooted.
Where'd you get your blade like that, Lumpy Face?
Hot Pie wanted to know.
Lumpy Head, corrected Lummy. He probably stole it.
I did not, she shouted.
Jon Snow had given her Needle. Maybe she had to let them call her Lumpyhead, but she wasn't going to let them call Jon a thief.
If he stole it, we could take it off him, said Hot Pie. It's not his, anyhow. I could use me a sword like that.
Lummy egged him on.
Go on, take it off him, I dare you.
Hot Pie kicked his donkey, riding closer.
Hey, Lumpy Face, you give me that sword.
His hair was the colour of straw, his fat face all sunburnt and peeling.
You don't know how to use it.
Yes, I do, Arya could have said. I killed a boy, a fat boy like you. I stabbed him in the belly and he died. And I'll kill you too, if you don't let me alone. Only she did not dare. Yoren didn't know about the stable boy, but she was afraid of what he might do if he found out. Arya was pretty sure that some of the other men were killers too, the three in the manacles for sure, but the queen wasn't looking for them, so it wasn't the same.
Look at him, brayed Lummy Greenhands. I'll bet he's going to cry now. You want to cry, Lumpyhead?
She had cried in her sleep the night before, dreaming of her father. Come morning, she'd woken red-eyed and dry, and could not have shed another tear if her life had hung on it.
"He's going to wet his pants,"
Hot Pie suggested.
"Leave him be,"
said the boy with the shaggy black hair who rode behind them. Lummy had named him the Bull, on account of this horned helm he had, that he polished all the time but never wore. Lummy didn't dare mock the Bull. He was older and big for his age, with a broad chest and strong-looking arms.
"You'd better give Hot Pie the sword, Harry," Lummy said. "Hot Pie wants it bad. He kicked a boy to death. He'll do the same to you, I'll bet." "I knocked him down, and I kicked him in the balls, and I kept kicking him there until he was dead,"
Hot Pie boasted.
"I kicked him all to pieces. His balls were broken open and bloody, and his cock turned black. You better give me the sword."
Arya slid her practice sword from her belt. "You can have this one," she told Hot Pie, not wanting to fight.
"That's just some stick."
He rode nearer and tried to reach over for Needle's hilt. Arya made the stick whistle as she laid the wood across the donkey's hindquarters. The animal hawed and bucked, dumping Hot Pie on the ground. She vaulted off her own donkey and poked him in the gut as he tried to get up, and he sat back down with a grunt. Then she whacked him across the face, and his nose made a crack like a branch breaking. Blood dribbled from his nostrils. When Hot Pie began to wail, Arya whirled towards Lummy Greenhands, who was sitting on his donkey open-mouthed. "You want some sword too?" she yelled, but he didn't. He raised dyed green hands in front of his face and squealed to her to get away. The Bull shouted,
"Behind you!"
And Arya spun. Hot Pie was on his knees, his fists closing around a big jagged rock. She let him through it, ducking her head as it sailed past. Then she flew at him. He raised a hand, and she hit it, and then his cheek, and then his knee. He grabbed for her, and she danced aside, and bounced the wood off the back of his head. He fell down and got up and stumbled after her, his red face all smeared with dirt and blood. Arya slid into a water dancer's stance and waited. When he came close enough, she lunged, right between his legs, so hard that if her wooden sword had had a point, it would have come out between his butt cheeks. By the time Yoren pulled her off him, Hot Pie was sprawled out on the ground, with his breeches brown and smelly, crying as Arya whapped him over and over and over. "Enough!" the Black Brother roared, prying the stick sword from her fingers. "You want to kill a fool?" When Lommy and some others started to squeal, the old man turned on them too.
"Shut your mouths, or I'll be shutting them for you. Any more of this, I'll tie you up behind the wagons and drag you to the wall." He spat. "And that goes twice for you, Harry. You come with me, boy, now."
They were all looking at her, even the three chained and manacled in the back of the wagon. The fat one snapped his pointy teeth together and hissed, but Arya ignored him. The old man dragged her well off the road into a tangle of trees, cursing and muttering all the while.
"If I had a thimble of sense, I would have left you in King's Landing. You hear me, boy?"
He always snarled that word, putting a bite in it so that she would be certain to hear.
"Unlace your breeches and pull them down. Go on. There's no one here to see. Do it."
Sullenly, Arya did as he said.
"Over there against the oak. Yes, like that."
She wrapped her arms around the trunk and pressed her face to the rough wood.
"You scream now. You scream loud."
"I won't," Arya thought stubbornly. But when Yoren laid the wood across the back of her bare thighs, the shriek burst out of her anyway.
"Think that hurt," he said. "Try this one."
The stick came whistling. Arya shrieked again, clutching the tree to keep from falling.
"One more."
She held on tight, chewing her lip, flinching when she heard it coming. The stroke made her jump and howl. "I won't cry," she thought. "I won't do that. I'm a Stark of Winterfell. Our sigil is the direwolf. Direwolves don't cry." She could feel a thin trickle of blood running down her left leg. Her thighs and cheeks were ablaze with pain.
"Maybe I got your attention now," Yoren said. "Next time you take that stick to one of your brothers, you get twice what you give. You hear me? Now, cover yourself."
"They're not my brothers," Arya thought, as she bent to yank up her breeches. But she knew better than to say so. Her hands fumbled with her belt and laces. Yoren was looking at her.
"You hurt."
"Calm as still water," she told herself, the way Syrio Forel had taught her. "Some." He spat.
"That pie boy's hurting worse. It wasn't him as killed your father, girl. Nor that thieving Lummy, neither. It in them won't bring him back."
"I know," Arya muttered sullenly.
"Here's something you didn't know. It wasn't supposed to happen like it did. I was set to leave, wagons bought and loaded, and a man comes with a boy for me, and a purse of coin, and a message. Never mind who it's from. Lord Eddard's to take the Blackishes to me. Wait, he'll be going with you. Why do you think I was there? Only something went queer."
"Joffrey," Arya breathed. "Someone should kill him."
"Someone will, but it won't be me, nor you neither."
Yoren tossed back her stick sword.
"Got Sire Leaf back at the wagons," he said as they made their way back to the road. "You chew some. It'll help with a sting."
It did help, some, though the taste of it was foul, and it made her spit look like blood. Even so, she walked for the rest of that day, and the day after, and the day after that, too raw to sit on a donkey. Hot Pie was worse off. Yoren had to shift some barrels around so he could lie in the back of a wagon on some sacks of barley, and he whimpered every time the wheels hit a rock. Lommy Greenhands wasn't even hurt, yet he stayed as far away from Arya as he could get.
"Every time you look at him, he twitches," the bull told her as she walked beside his donkey.
She did not answer. It seemed safer not to talk to anyone. That night, she lay upon her thin blanket on the hard ground, staring up at the great red comet. The comet was splendid and scary all at once.
"The Red Sword," the bull named it.
He claimed it looked like a sword, the blade still red-hot from the forge. When Arya squinted the right way, she could see the sword too. Only it wasn't a new sword. It was ice. Her father's great sword. All ripply Valyrian steel, and the red was Lord Eddard's blood on the blade, after Sir Ilion, the king's justice, had cut off his head. Yoren had made her look away when it happened, yet it seemed to her that the comet looked like ice must have after. When at last she slept, she dreamed of home. The King's Road wound its way past Winterfell on its way to the wall, and Yoren had promised he'd leave her there with no one any wiser about who she'd been. She yearned to see her mother again, and Rob and Bran and Rickon, but it was Jon Snow she thought of most. She wished somehow they could come to the wall before Winterfell, so Jon might muss up her hair and call her little sister. She'd tell him, "I missed you," and he'd say it too at the very same moment, the way they always used to say things together. She would have liked that. She would have liked that better than anything. Bran. The morning had dawned clear and cold, with a crispness that hinted at the end of summer. They set forth at daybreak to see a man beheaded, 20 in all, and Bran rode among them, nervous with excitement. This was the first time he had been deemed old enough to go with his lord father and his brothers to see the king's justice done. It was the 9th year of summer and the 7th of Bran's life. The man had been taken outside a small holdfast in the hills. Rob thought he was a wildling, his sword sworn to Mance Rayder, the king beyond the wall. It made Bran's skin prickle to think of it. He remembered the hearth tales old Nan told them.
"The wildlings were cruel men," she said, "slavers and slayers and thieves. They consorted with giants and ghouls, stole girl children in the dead of night and drank blood from polished horns, and their women lay with the others in the long night to sire terrible half-human children."
But the man they found bound hand and foot to the holdfast wall, awaiting the king's justice, was old and scrawny, not much taller than Rob. He had lost both ears and a finger to frostbite, and he dressed all in black, the same as the brother of the Night's Watch, except that his furs were ragged and greasy. The breath of man and horse mingled, steaming in the cold morning air, as his lord father had the man cut down from the wall and dragged before them. Rob and John sat tall and still on their horses, with Bran between them on his pony, trying to seem older than 7, trying to pretend that he'd seen all this before. A faint wind blew through the holdfast gate. Over their heads flapped the banner of the Starks of Winterfell, a grey direwolf racing across an ice-white field. Bran's father sat solemnly on his horse, long brown hair stirring in the wind. His closely trimmed beard was shot with white, making him look older than his 35 years. He had a grim cast to his grey eyes this day, and he seemed not at all the man who would sit before the fire in the evening and talk softly of the age of heroes and the children of the forest. He had taken off father's face, Bran thought, and donned the face of Lord Stark of Winterfell. There were questions asked, and answers given there in the chill of morning, but afterwards Bran could not recall much of what had been said. Finally, his lord father gave a command, and two of his guardsmen dragged the ragged man to the ironwood stump in the centre of the square. They forced his head down onto the hard, black wood. Lord Eddard Stark dismounted, and his ward, Theon Greyjoy, brought forth the sword. Ice, that sword was called. It was as wide as a man's hand, and taller even than Rob. The blade was Valyrian steel, spell-forged and dark as smoke. Nothing held an edge like Valyrian steel. His father peeled off his gloves and handed them to Jory Cassel, the captain of the household guard. He took hold of Ice with both hands and said, "In the name of Robert of the House Baratheon, the first of the name, King of the Andals and the Rhaenar and the First Men, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms and Protector of the Realm, by the word of Eddard of the House Stark, Lord of Winterfell and Warden of the North, I do sentence you to die." He lifted the great sword high above his head. Bran's bastard brother, Jon Snow, moved closer.
"Keep the pony well in hand," he whispered, "and don't look away. Father will know if you do."
Bran kept his pony well in hand and did not look away. His father took off the man's head with a single sure stroke. Blood sprayed out across the snow, as red as summer wine. One of the horses reared and had to be restrained to keep from bolting. Bran could not take his eyes off the blood. The snows around the stump drank it eagerly, reddening as he watched. The head bounced off a thick root and rolled. It came up near Greyjoy's feet. Theon was a lean, dark youth of 19, who found everything amusing. He laughed, put his boot on the head, and kicked it away. "Ass," John muttered, low enough so Greyjoy could not hear. He put a hand on Bran's shoulder, and Bran looked over at his bastard brother. "You did well," John told him solemnly. John was 14, an old hand at justice. It seemed colder on the long ride back to Winterfell, though the wind had died by then and the sun was higher in the sky. Bran rode with his brothers well ahead of the main party, his pony struggling hard to keep up with their horses. "The deserter died bravely," Rob said. He was big and broad and growing every day with his mother's colouring, the fair skin, red-brown hair, and blue eyes of the Tullys of Riverrun. "He had courage, at the least." "No," Jon Snow said quietly. "It was not courage. This one was dead of fear. You could see it in his eyes, Stark." Jon's eyes were a grey so dark they seemed almost black, but there was little they did not see. He was of an age with Rob, but they did not look alike. Jon was slender, where Rob was muscular, dark where Rob was fair, graceful and quick, where his half-brother was strong and fast. Rob was not impressed. "The others take his eyes," he swore. "He died well. Race you to the bridge?" "Done," John said, kicking his horse forward. Rob cursed and followed, and they galloped off down the trail. Rob laughing and hooting, John silent and intent. The hoofs of their horses kicked up showers of snow as they went. Bran did not try to follow. His pony could not keep up. He had seen the ragged man's eyes, and he was thinking of them now. After a while, the sound of Rob's laughter receded, and the woods grew silent again. So deep in thought was he that he never heard the rest of the party until his father moved up to ride beside him. "Are you well, Bran?" he asked, not unkindly. "Yes, father," Bran told him. He looked up, wrapped in his furs and leathers, mounted on his great war horse. The Lord Father loomed over him like a giant. "Rob says the man died bravely, but John said he was afraid." "And what do you think?" his father asked. Bran thought about it. "Can a man still be brave if he's afraid?" "That is the only time a man can be brave," his father told him. "Do you understand why I did it?" "He was a wildling," Bran said. "They carry off women and sell them to the others." His Lord Father smiled. "Old Nan has been telling you stories again. In truth, the man was an oath-breaker, a deserter from the Night's Watch. No man is more dangerous. The deserter knows his life is forfeit if he is taken, so he will not flinch from any crime, no matter how vile. But you mistake me. The question was not why the man had to die, but why I must do it. Bran had no answer for that. King Robert has a headsman, he said uncertainly. He does, his father admitted, as did the Targaryen kings before him. Yet our way is the older way. The blood of the first men still flows in the veins of the Starks, and we hold to the belief that the man who passes the sentence should swing the sword. If you would take a man's life, you owe it to him to look into his eyes and hear his final words. And if you cannot bear to do that, then perhaps a man does not deserve to die. One day, Bran, you will be Robb's banner man, holding a keep of your own for your brother and your king, and justice will fall to you. When that day comes, you must take no pleasure in the task, but neither must you look away. A ruler who hides behind paid executioners soon forgets what death is. That was when John reappeared on the crest of the hill before him. He waved and shouted down at them, "Father, Bran, come quickly! See what Robb has found!" Then he was gone again. Jorry rode up beside them. "Trouble, my lord?" "Beyond a doubt," his lord father said. "Come, let us see what mischief my sons have rooted out now." He sent his horse into a trot. Jorry and Bran and the rest came after. They found Robb on the river bank north of the bridge, with John still mounted beside him. The late summer snows had been heavy this moon turn. Robb stood knee-deep in white, his hood pulled back so the sun shone in his hair. He was cradling something in his arm while the boys talked in hushed, excited voices. The riders picked their way carefully through the drifts, groping for solid footing on the hidden, uneven ground. Jorry Cassell and Theon Greyjoy were the first to reach the boys. Greyjoy was laughing and joking as he rode. Bran heard the breath go out of him. "Gods!" he exclaimed, struggling to keep control of his horse as he reached for his sword. Jorry's sword was already out. "Robb, get away from it!" he called as his horse reared under him. Robb grinned and looked up from the bundle in his arms. "She can't hurt you," he said. "She's dead, Jorry." Bran was afire with curiosity by then. He would have spurred the pony faster, but his father made them dismount beside the bridge and approach on foot. Bran jumped off and ran. By then, John, Jorry, and Theon Greyjoy had all dismounted as well. "What in the seven hells is it?" Greyjoy was saying. "A wolf," Robb told him. "A freak," Greyjoy said. "Look at the size of it." Bran's heart was thumping in his chest as he pushed through a waist-high drift to his brother's side. Half buried in the blood-stained snow, a huge dark shape slumped in death. Ice had formed in its shaggy grey fur, and the faint smell of corruption clung to it like a woman's perfume. Bran glimpsed blind eyes crawling with maggots, a wide mouthful of yellow teeth, but it was the size of it that made him gasp. It was bigger than his pony, twice the size of the largest hound in his father's kennel. "It's no freak," John said calmly. "That's a direwolf. They grow larger than the other kind." Theon Greyjoy said, "There's not been a direwolf sighted south of the Wall in 200 years. "I see one now," John replied. Bran tore his eyes away from the monster. That was when he noticed the bundle in Robb's arms. He gave a cry of delight and moved closer. The pup was a tiny ball of grey-black fur, its eyes still closed. It nuzzled blindly against Robb's chest as he cradled it, searching for milk among his leathers, making a sad little whimpery sound. Bran reached out hesitantly. "Go on," Robb told him. "You can touch him." Bran gave the pup a quick nervous stroke, then turned as John said, "Here you go." His half-brother put a second pup into his arms. "There are five of them." Bran sat down in the snow and hugged the wolf pup to his face. Its fur was soft and warm against his cheek. "Direwolves loose in the realm after so many years," muttered Hullan, the master of horse. "I like it not." "It's a sign," Jorry said. Father frowned. "This is only a dead animal, Jorry," he said. Yet he seemed troubled. Snow crunched under his boots as he moved around the body. "Do we know what killed her?" "There's something in the throat," Rob told him, proud to have found the answer before his father even asked. "There, just under the jaw." His father knelt and groped under the beast's head with his hand. He gave a yank and held it up for all to see. A foot of shattered antler, tine snapped off, all wet with blood. A sudden silence descended over the party. The men looked at the antler uneasily, and no one dared to speak. Even Bran could sense their fear, though he did not understand. His father tossed the antler to the side and cleansed his hands in the snow. "I'm surprised she lived long enough even to whelp," he said. His voice broke the spell. "Maybe she didn't," Jorry said. "I've heard tales. Maybe the bitch was already dead when the pups came." "Born with the dead," another man put in. "Worse luck." "No matter," said Holland. "They'll be dead soon enough, too." Bran gave a wordless cry of dismay. "The sooner the better," Theon Greyjoy agreed. He drew his sword. "Give the beast here, Bran." The little thing squirmed against him, as if it heard and understood. "No," Bran cried out fiercely. "It's mine." "Put away your sword, Greyjoy," Rob said. For a moment he sounded as commanding as their father, like the lord he would someday be. "We will keep these pups." "You cannot do that, boy," said Harwin, who was Holland's son. "It'll be a mercy to kill them," Holland said. Bran looked to his lord father for rescue, but got only a frown, a furrowed brow. "Holland speaks truly, son. Better a swift death than a hard one from cold and starvation." "No." He could feel tears welling in his eyes, and he looked away. He did not want to cry in front of his father. Rob resisted stubbornly. "Sir Roderick's red bitch whelped again last week," he said. "It was a small litter, only two live pups. She'll have milk enough. She'll rip them apart when they try to nurse." "Lord Stark," John said. It was strange to hear him call father that, so formal. Bran looked at him with desperate hope. "There are five pups," he told father. "Three male, two female." "What of it, John?" "You have five true-born children," John said. "Three sons, two daughters. The dire wolf is a sigil of your house. Your children were meant to have these pups, my lord." Bran saw his father's face change, saw the other men exchange glances. He loved John with all his heart at that moment. Even at seven, Bran understood what his brother had done. The count had come right only because John had omitted himself. He had included the girls, included even Rickon the baby, but not the bastard who bore the surname Snow, the name that custom decreed be given to all those in the north unlucky enough to be born with no name of their own. Their father understood as well. "You want no pup for yourself, John?" he asked softly. "The direwolf graces the banner of House Stark," John pointed out. "I am no Stark, father." Their lord father regarded John thoughtfully. Rob rushed into the silence he left. "I will nurse him myself, father," he promised. "I will soak a towel with warm milk and give him suck from that." "Me too," Bran echoed. The lord weighed his sons long and carefully with his eyes. "Easy to say, and harder to do. I will not have you wasting the servants' time with this. If you want these pups, you will feed them yourselves, is that understood?" Bran nodded eagerly. The pup squirmed in his grasp, licked at his face with a warm tongue. "You must train them as well," the father said. "You must train them. The kennel master will have nothing to do with these monsters, I promise you that. And the gods help you if you neglect them or brutalize them or train them badly. These are not dogs to beg for treats and slink off at a kick. A dire wolf will rip a man's arm off his shoulder as easily as a dog will kill a rat. You sure you want this?"
"Yes, father," Bran said.
"Yes," Rob agreed. "The pups may die anyway, despite all you do."
"They won't die," Rob said. "We won't let them die."
"Keep them, then. Jorry, Desmond, gather up the other pups. It's time we were back to Winterfell." It was not until they were mounted and on their way that Bran allowed himself to taste the sweet air of victory.
By then his pup was snuggling inside his leathers, warm against him, safe for the long ride home. Bran was wondering what to name him. Halfway across the bridge, John pulled up suddenly. "What is it, John?" the Lord Father asked. "Can't you hear it?" Bran could hear the wind in the trees, the clatter of their hooves on the ironwood planks, the whimpering of his hungry pup, but John was listening to something else. "There," John said. He swung his horse around and galloped back across the bridge. They watched him dismount where the direwolf lay dead in the snow, watched him kneel. A moment later he was riding back to them, smiling. "He must have crawled away from the others," John said. "Or been driven away," the father said, looking at the sixth pup. His fur was white where the rest of the litter was grey. His eyes were red as the blood of the ragged man who had died that morning. Bran thought it curious that this pup alone would have opened his eyes while the others were still blind. "An albino," Theo Greyjoy said with wry amusement. "This one will die even faster than the others." Jon Snow gave his father's ward a long, chilling look. "I think not, Greyjoy," he said. "This one belongs to me."
Jamie.
An east wind blew through his tangled hair, as soft and fragrant as Cersei's fingers. He could hear birds singing and feel the river moving beneath the boat as the sweep of the oars sent them toward the pale pink dawn. After so long in darkness, the world was so sweet that Jamie Lannister felt dizzy.
"I am alive and drunk on sunlight."
A laugh burst from his lips, sudden as a quail flushed from cover. "Quiet," the wench grumbled, scowling. Scowl suited her broad, homely face better than a smile. Not that Jamie had ever seen her smiling. He amused himself by picturing her in one of Cersei's silken gowns in place of a studded leather jerkin. As well dress a cow in silk as this one. But the cow could row. Beneath her rough-spun brown breeches were calves like cords of wood, and the long muscles of her arms stretched and tightened with each stroke of the oars. Even after rowing half the night, she showed no signs of tiring, which was more than could be said for his cousin, Sir Cleos, labouring on the other oar.
"A big, strong peasant wench to look at, yet she speaks like one high-born, and wears longsword and dagger. Ah, but can she use them?"
Jamie meant to find out, as soon as he'd rid himself of these fetters. He wore iron manacles on his wrists and a matching pair about his ankles, joined by a length of heavy chain no more than a foot long. "You'd think my word as a Lannister was not good enough," he japed as they bound him. He'd been very drunk by then, thanks to Catelyn Stark. Of their escape from River Run he recalled only bits and pieces. There had been some trouble with the jailer, but the big wench had overcome him. After that they had climbed an endless stair around and around. His legs were weak as grass, and he'd stumbled twice or thrice until the wench lent him an arm to lean on. At some point he was bundled into a traveller's cloak and shoved into the bottom of a skiff. He remembered listening to Lady Catelyn command someone to raise the portcullis on the watergate. She was sending Sir Cleos Frey back to King's Landing with new terms for the Queen. She declared in a tone that brooked no argument. He must have drifted off then. The wine had made him sleepy, and it felt good to stretch, a luxury his chains had not permitted him in the cell. Jamie had long ago learned to snatch sleep in the saddle during a march. This was no harder.
"Tyrion is going to laugh himself sick when he hears how I slept through my own escape."
He was awake now, though, and the fetters were irksome.
"My lady," he called out, "if you strike off these chains, I'll spell you at those oars."
She scowled again, her face all horse teeth and glowering suspicion.
"You'll wear your chains, Kingslayer. You figure to row all the way to King's Landing, wench? You will call me Brian, not wench. My name is Sir Jamie, not Kingslayer.
Do you deny that you slew a king?
No.
Do you deny your sex? If so, unlace those breeches and show me.
He gave her an innocent smile.
I'd ask you to open your bodice, but from the look of you, that wouldn't prove much.
Sir Cleos fretted.
Cousin, remember your courtesies.
The Lannister blood runs thin in this one.
Cleos was his Aunt Jenna's son by that dullard Eamon Frey, who had lived in terror of Lord Tywin Lannister since the day he wed his sister. When Lord Walder Frey had brought the twins into the war on the side of Riverrun, Sir Eamon had chosen his wife's allegiance over his father's.
Castle Rock got the worst of that bargain, Jaime reflected.
Sir Cleos looked like a weasel, fought like a goose, and had the courage of an especially brave ewe. Lady Stark had promised him release if he delivered her message to Tyrion, and Sir Cleos had solemnly vowed to do so. They'd all done a deal of vowing back in that cell, Jaime most of all. That was Lady Catelyn's price for loosing him. She had laid the point of the big wench's sword against his heart and said, "Swear that you will never again take up arms against Stark nor Tully. Swear that you will compel your brother to honour his pledge to return my daughter safe and unharmed. Swear, on your honour as a knight, on your honour as a Lannister, on your honour as a sworn brother of the King's Guard. Swear it by your sister's life and your father's, and your son's, by the old guards and the new, and I'll send you back to your sister. Refuse, and I will have your blood." He remembered the prick of the steel through his rags as she twisted the point of the sword.
"I wonder what the High Septon would have to say about the sanctity of oaths, sworn while dead drunk, chained to a wall with a sword pressed to your chest."
Not that Jaime was truly concerned about that fat fawn or the guards he claimed to serve. He remembered the pail Lady Catelyn had kicked over in his cell. A strange woman, to trust her girls to a man with shit for honour, though she was trusting him as little as she dared.
"She is putting her hope in Tyrion, not in me."
"Perhaps she is not so stupid after all," he said aloud. His captor took it wrong. "I am not stupid, nor deaf." He was gentle with her. Mocking this one would be so easy, there would be no sport in it.
"I was speaking to myself, and not to you. It's an easy habit to slip into, in a cell."
She frowned at him, pushing the oars forward, pulling them back, pushing them forward, saying nothing.
"As glib of tongue as she is fair of face. By your speech, I judge you nobly born."
"My father is Selwyn of Tarth. By the grace of the gods, Lord of Evenfall."
Even that was given grudgingly.
"Tarth," Jaime said, "a ghastly large rock in the narrow sea, as I recall. And Evenfall is sworn to Storm's End. How is it that you serve Rob of Winterfell?"
"It is Lady Catelyn I serve. She commanded me to deliver you safe to your brother Tyrion at King's Landing, not to bandy words with you. Be silent."
"I've had a belly full of silence, woman."
"Talk with Sir Cleos, then. I have no words for monsters."
Jaime hooted.
"Oh, are there monsters hereabouts? Hiding beneath the water, perhaps, in that thick of willows? And me, without my sword?
A man who would violate his own sister, murder his king, and fling an innocent child to his death deserves no other name."
"Innocent? The wretched boy was spying on us."
All Jaime had wanted was an hour alone with Cersei. The journey north had been one long torment, seeing her every day, unable to touch her, knowing that Robert stumbled drunkenly into her bed every night in that great creaking wheelhouse. Tyrion had done his best to keep him in a good humour, but it had not been enough.
"You will be courteous as concerns Cersei, wench," he warned her.
"My name is Brienne, not wench."
"What do you care what a monster calls you?"
"My name is Brienne," she repeated, dogged as a hound.
"Lady Brienne."
She looked so uncomfortable that Jaime sensed a weakness,
Or would Sir Brain be more to your taste? He laughed. No, I fear not. You can trick out a milk cow in crupper, crinet, and chamfron, and bart her all in silk, but that doesn't mean you can ride her into battle.
Cousin Jamie, please, you ought not to speak so roughly. Under his cloak, Sir Cleos wore a surcoat quartered with the twin towers of House Frey and the golden line of Lannister. We have far to go. We should not quarrel among ourselves.
When I quarrel, I do it with a sword, cuz. I was speaking to the lady. Tell me, wench, are all the women on Tarth as homely as you? I pity the men if so. Perhaps they do not know what real women look like, living on a dreary mountain in the sea.
Tarth is beautiful, the wench grunted between strokes. The sapphire oil, it's called. Be quiet, monster, unless you mean to make me gag you.
She's rude as well, isn't she, cuz? Jamie asked Sir Cleos. Though she has steel in her spine, I'll grant you. Not many men dare name me monster to my face. Though behind my back they speak freely enough, I have no doubt.
Sir Cleos coughed nervously.
Lady Brian had those lies from Catelyn Stark, no doubt. The Starks cannot hope to defeat you with sword, sir, so now they make war with poisoned words.
They did defeat me with swords, you chinless cretin.
Jamie smiled knowingly. Men will read all sorts of things into a knowing smile if you let them.
Has Cousin Cleos truly swallowed this kettle of dung, or is he striving to ingratiate himself? What do we have here, an honest mutton head or a lick spittle?
Sir Cleos prattled on blithely.
Any man who believed that a sworn brother of the King's Guard would harm a child does not know the meaning of honour.
Lick spittle.
If truth be told, Jamie had come to rue heaving Brandon Stark out of that window. Cersei had given him no end of grief afterwards when the boy refused to die.
He was seven, Jamie, she berated him. Even if he understood what he saw, we should have been able to frighten him into silence.
Well, I didn't think you'd want.
You never think. If the boy should wake and tell his father what he saw.
If.
He had pulled her into his lap. If he wakes, we'll say he was dreaming. We'll call him a liar. And should worse come to worse, I'll kill Ned Stark.
And then what do you imagine Robert will do?
Let Robert do as he pleases. I'll go to war with him if I must. The war for Cersei's cunt, the singers will call it.
Jamie, let go of me, she raged, struggling to rise. Instead, he had kissed her. For a moment she resisted, but then her mouth opened under his. He remembered the taste of wine and cloves on her tongue. She gave a shudder. His hand went to her bodice and yanked, tearing the silk so her breast spilled free, and for a time the Stark boy had been forgotten. Had Cersei remembered him afterward, and hired this man, Lady Catelyn spoke of, to make sure the boy never woke?
If she wanted him dead, she would have sent me. It's not like her to choose a cat's paw who would make such a royal butch of the killing.
Downriver, the rising sun shimmered against the wind-whipped surface of the river. The south shore was red clay, smooth as any road. Smaller streams fed into the greater, and the rotting trunks of drowned trees clung to the banks. The north shore was wilder. High, rocky bluffs rose 20 feet above them, crowned by stands of beech, oak, and chestnut. Jamie espied a watchtower on the heights ahead, growing taller with every stroke of the oars. Long before they were upon it, he knew it stood abandoned, its weathered stones overgrown with climbing roses. When the wind shifted, Sir Cleos helped the big wench run up the sail, a stiff triangle of striped red and blue canvas. Tully collars, sure to cause them grief if they encountered any Lannister forces on the river, but it was the only sail they had. Brian took the rudder. Jamie threw out the leeboard, his chains rattling as he moved.
After that they made better speed, with wind and current both favouring their flight. "We could save a deal of travelling if you deliver me to my father instead of my brother," he pointed out.
"Lady Catelyn's daughters are in King's Landing. I will return with the girls or not at all."
Jamie turned to Sir Cleos.
Cousin, lend me your knife."
"No,"
the woman tensed. "I will not have you armed." Her voice was as unyielding as stone.
"She fears me, even in irons."
"Cleos, it seems I must ask you to shave me. Leave the beard, but take the hair off my head."
"You'd be shaved bald?" asked Cleos Frey.
"The realm knows Jaime Lannister as a beardless knight with long golden hair. A bald man with a filthy yellow beard may pass unnoticed. I'd sooner not be recognized while I'm in irons."
The dagger was not as sharp as it might have been. Cleos hacked away manfully, sawing and ripping his way through the mats and tossing the hair over the side. The golden curls floated on the surface of the water, gradually falling astern. As the tangles vanished, a louse went crawling down his neck. Jamie caught it and crushed it against his thumbnail. Sir Cleos picked others from his scalp and flicked them into the water. Jamie doused his head and made Sir Cleos wet the blade before he let him scrape away the last inch of yellow stubble. When that was done, they trimmed back his beard as well. The reflection in the water was a man he did not know. Not only was he bald, but he looked as though he had aged 5 years in that dungeon. His face was thinner, with hollows under his eyes and lines he did not remember.
"I don't look as much like Cersei this way. She'll hate that."
By midday, Sir Cleos had fallen asleep. His snores sounded like ducks mating. Jamie stretched out to watch the world flow past. After the dark cell, every rock and tree was a wonder. A few one-room shacks came and went, perched on tall poles that made them look like cranes. Of the folk who lived there, they saw no sign. Birds flew overhead, or cried out from the trees along the shore, and Jamie glimpsed silvery fish knifing through the water.
"Tully trout, there's a bad omen," he thought, until he saw worse.
One of the floating logs that passed turned out to be a dead man, bloodless and swollen. His cloak was tangled in the roots of a fallen tree, its colour unmistakably Lannister crimson. He wondered if the corpse had been someone he knew. The forks of the trident were the easiest way to move goods or men across the riverlands. In times of peace, they would have encountered fisherfolk in their skiffs, grain barges being poled downstream, merchants selling needles and bolts of cloth from floating shops, perhaps even a gaily painted mummer's boat with quilted sails of 50 colours, making its way upriver from village to village and castle to castle. But the war had taken its toll. They sailed past villages, but saw no villagers. An empty net, slashed and torn, and hanging from some trees, was the only sign of fisher folk. A young girl, watering a horse, rode off as soon as she glimpsed their sail. Later, they passed a dozen peasants digging in a field beneath the shell of a burnt tower house. The men gazed at them with dull eyes and went back to their labours once they decided the skiff was no threat. The Red Fork was wide and slow, a meandering river of loops and bends dotted with tiny wooded islets and frequently choked by sandbars and snags that lurked just below the water's surface. Brian seemed to have a keen eye for the dangers, though, and always seemed to find the channel. When Jamie complimented her on her knowledge of the river, she looked at him suspiciously and said, "I do not know the river. Tarth is an island. I learned to manage oars and sail before I ever sat a horse." Sir Cleos sat up and rubbed at his eyes. "Gods, my arms are sore. I hope the wind lasts." He sniffed at it. "I smell rain." Jamie would welcome a good rain. The dungeons of River Run were not the cleanest place in the Seven Kingdoms. By now he must smell like an overripe cheese. Cleos squinted downriver.
"Smoke!"
A thin grey finger crooked them on. It was rising from the south bank several miles on, twisting and curling. Below, Jamie made out the smouldering remains of a large building, and a live oak full of dead women. The crows had scarcely started on their corpses. The thin ropes cut deep into the soft flesh of their throats, and when the wind blew, they twisted and swayed. "This was not chivalrously done," said Brian, when they were close enough to see it clearly. "No true knight would condone such wanton butchery."
"True knights see worse every time they ride to war, wench," said Jamie, "and do worse, yes."
Brian turned the rudder towards the shore. "I'll leave no innocence to be food for crows."
"A heartless wench. Crows need to eat as well. Stay to the river and leave the dead alone, woman."
They landed upstream of where the great oak leaned out over the water. As Brian lowered the sail, Jamie climbed out, clumsy in his chains. The red fork filled his boots and soaked through the ragged breeches. Laughing, he dropped to his knees, plunged his head under the water, and came up drenched and dripping. His hands were caked with dirt, and when he rubbed them clean in the current, they seemed thinner and paler than he remembered. His legs were stiff as well, and unsteady when he put his weight upon them.
"I was too bloody long in Huster Tully's dungeon."
Brian and Cleos dragged the skiff onto the bank. The corpses hung above their heads, ripening in death like foul fruit.
"One of us will need to cut them down," the wench said.
"I'll climb," Jamie waded ashore, clanking. "Just get these chains off."
The wench was staring up at one of the dead women. Jamie shuffled closer with small stutter steps, the only kind the footlong chain permitted. When he saw the crude sign hung about the neck of the highest corpse, he smiled.
"They lay with lions," he read. "Oh yes, woman, this was most unchivalrously done. But by your side, not mine. I wonder who they were, these women."
"Tavern wenches," said Sir Cleos Frey. "This was an inn, I remember it now. Some men of my escort spent the night here when we last returned to River Run."
Nothing remained of the building but the stone foundation and a tangle of collapsed beams, charred black. Smoke still rose from the ashes. Jamie left brothels and whores to his brother Tyrion. Circe was the only woman he had ever wanted.
"The girls pleasured some of my lord father's soldiers, it would seem. Perhaps serve them food and drink. That's how they earn their traitor's collars, with a kiss and a cup of ale."
He glanced up and down the river to make certain they were quite alone.
"This is Brackenland. Lord Jonas might have ordered them killed. My father burned his castle. I fear he loves us not."
"It might be Mark Piper's work," said Sir Cleos, "or that wisp of the wood, Beric Dondarrion, though I'd heard he kills only soldiers. Perhaps a band of Roos Bolton's Northmen."
"Bolton was defeated by my father on the Green Fork."
"But not broken," said Sir Cleos. "He came south again when Lord Tywin marched against the Fords. The word at Riverrun was that he'd taken Harrenhal from Sir Aimery Lorch."
Jamie liked the sound of that not at all. "Brian," he said, granting her the courtesy of the name in the hopes that she might listen,
"if Lord Bolton holds Harrenhal, both the Trident and the King's Road are likely watched."
He thought he saw a touch of uncertainty in her big blue eyes.
"You are under my protection. They'd need to kill me."
"I shouldn't think that would trouble them."
"I am as good a fighter as you," she said defensively. "I was one of King Renly's chosen seven. With his own hands he cloaked me with the striped silk of the Rainbow Guard."
"The Rainbow Guard? Oh, you and six other girls, was it? A singer once said that all maids are fair in silk. But he never met you, did he?"
The woman turned red.
"We have graves to dig."
She went to climb the tree. The lower limbs of the oak were big enough for her to stand upon, once she had gotten up the trunk. She walked among the leaves, dagger in hand, cutting down the corpses. Flies swarmed around the bodies as they fell, and the stench grew worse with each one she dropped.
"This is a deal of trouble to take for whores," Sir Cleos complained. "What are we supposed to dig with? We have no spades, and I will not use my sword.
Brian gave a shout. She jumped down rather than climbing.
"To the boat! Be quick! There's a sail!"
They made what haste they could, though Jamie could hardly run, and had to be pulled back into the skiff by his cousin. Brian shoved off with an oar and raised sail hurriedly.
"Sir Cleos, I'll need you to row as well."
He did as she bid. The skiff began to cut the water a bit faster. Current, wind, and oars all worked for them. Jamie sat chained, peering upriver. Only the top of the other sail was visible. With the way the Red Fork looped, it looked to be across the fields, moving north behind a screen of trees while they moved south. But he knew that was deceptive. He lifted both hands to shade his eyes.
"Mud red and watery blue," he announced.
Brian's big mouth worked soundlessly, giving her the look of a cow chewing its cud.
"Faster, sir."
The inn soon vanished behind them, and they lost sight of the top of the sail as well, but that meant nothing. Once the pursuers swung around the loop, they would become visible again.
"We can hope the noble Tullys will stop to bury the dead whores, I suppose."
The prospect of returning to his cell did not appeal to Jamie.
"Tyrion could think of something clever now, but all that occurs to me is to go at them with a sword."
For the good part of an hour they played peek and seek with the pursuers, sweeping around bends and between small wooded isles. Just when they were starting to hope that somehow they might have left behind the pursuit, the distant sail became visible again. Sir Cleos paused in his stroke.
"The others take them."
He wiped the sweat from his brow.
"Row," Brian said.
"That is a river galley coming after us," Jamie announced after he'd watched for a while. With every stroke, it seemed to grow a little larger.
9 oars on each side, which means 18 men. More if they're crowded on fighters as well as rowers, and larger sails than ours. We cannot outrun her."
Sir Cleos froze at his oars.
18, you said?
6 for each of us. I'd want 8, but these bracelets hinder me somewhat.
Jamie held up his wrists.
Unless the Lady Brian would be so kind as to unshackle me.
She ignored him, putting all her efforts into her stroke.
We had half a night's start on them, Jamie said. They've been rowing since dawn, resting 2 oars at a time. They'll be exhausted. Just now the sight of our sail has given them a burst of strength, but that will not last. We ought to be able to kill a good many of them.
Sir Cleos gaped.
But there are 18.
At the least. More like 20 or 25.
His cousin groaned.
We can't hope to defeat 18.
Did I say we could?
The best we can hope for is to die with swords in our hands. He was perfectly sincere. Jamie Lannister had never been afraid of death. Brian broke off rowing. Sweat had stuck strands of her flax-coloured hair to her forehead, and her grimace made her look homelier than ever.
"You are under my protection," she said, her voice so thick with anger that it was almost a growl. He had to laugh at such fierceness.
"She's the hound with tits," he thought, or would be, if she had any tits to speak of.
"Then protect me, wench, or free me to protect myself."
The galley was skimming downriver, a great wooden dragonfly. The water around her was churned white by the furious action of her oars. She was gaining visibly, the men on her deck crowding forward as she came on. Metal glinted in their hands, and Jamie could see bows as well.
Archers.
He hated archers.
At the prow of the onrushing galley stood a stocky man with a bald head, bushy grey eyebrows, and brawny arms. Over his mail he wore a soiled white surcoat with a weeping willow embroidered.